Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
With threats to our nation waiting around every corner, adaptability is more important than ever. When conditions change without notice, quick strategic thinking is crucial, and with obstacles consistently impending, determination is essential in overcoming them. It's this willingness, decisiveness, and resilience that sets Marines apart. With our fighting spirit, we don't just fight battles, we win them. Marines are the constant our nation counts on to fight the unknown, and through adaptable problem solving, we do just that. Learn more at marines.com.
This podcast is part of the Sports Social Podcast Network. This podcast is part of the Sports Social Podcast Network. This podcast is part of the Sports Social Podcast Network. This podcast is part of the Sports Social Podcast Network. This podcast is part of the Sports Social Podcast Network. This podcast is part of the Sports Social Podcast Network. This podcast is part of the Sports Social Podcast Network.
This week on The Marketer's Report, Patrizio Spagnoletto, Global Chief Marketing Officer, Direct-to-Consumer for Warner Brothers Discovery, weighs in on building trust.
Trust is a really hard thing to build and a really easy thing to destroy, and we have to be very respectful about that. Our partnership with iHeart has really helped us build that trust and that relationship with the on-air talent.
As the number one audio company, iHeartMedia gives you access to all, every audience, live conversations, trusted influencers, and the data you need to grow. Go to iHeartResults.com for more.
Evening, everybody. My name's Kevin Graham. He's Russell Boyce, and this is Tuesday Night Screamer Celica. It's 6:30, so what else would you do at 6:30 on a Tuesday night? So all you guys who are listening to BBC Scotland, Radio Clyde, Real Radio, is Real Radio still a thing? I didn't ken if Real Radio is still a thing or no.
I don't think so.
Is it? I don't know. Is it New Heart FM or something like that, or Magic, or We Play 70s cheese every hour on the hour FM or something like that. Russell, how are you doing?
I'm good, mate. I'm good. It's good to be on Screamers. Week three already, Kev. We're racing through them, man.
And we didn't think we were going to get past week one.
I know. I'm surprised ourselves a wee bit.
I know. Now, Russell, go and tell us where were you today. Go and tell us.
So I was on a Pakistani news channel called Indus News. It was an email out the blue, Kev. You know, I thought it was maybe a bit of a wind-up, and I thought, I'll just go with it, and we'll see what happens. And then, before you knew it, this morning I was speaking to a producer on the phone telling me to comb my hair in that, man. I was like, cheeky bugger. And then I just went with it. It was all good. And I realise I've got a completely different voice that I didn't know anything about, Kev. This completely telephone manner just came over me, man. So I suppose I couldn't go full on voice to people across the globe. I think it's only fair that I try and, like, speak in relevant English. Apart from Screamer Celica, of course.
Is it true that they did call you a sports journalist? Sport, Russell Boyce, sports journalist.
Brilliant, eh? If I want again, I'll put a pen behind my ear, man. You know what I mean?
I know. Unbelievable. I mean, it shows you the reach a Celtic state of mind. that you're getting a news channel based in Pakistan asking you to come on to speak about Liverpool against Wolves. Not even Celtic. Which is utterly bizarre as well.
I don't think it's the chat mainstream that's doing it, so you never know, man. You never know.
Oh, right. Let's get on with this. Let's get on with this. The Wolves. So, this week, we're jumping in the green and white DeLorean. Yes. DeLorean. And we're going back to August 2002. The 14th of August 2002, to be exact. Celtic were on the back of the two in a row. Martin O'Neill had just won the championship for two in a row. We were going for three in a row that season. Yep. And we were looking to get back into the Champions League. Now, these were the high salon days where we only had to play one qualifier. And we went into the third qualifying round. And we got a team called FC Basel from Switzerland, who were a team that are backed by a Swiss pharmaceutical company. And I must admit, after the taste of the Champions League the previous season, I thought it was a pretty good draw. I had a look at that Celtic squad and went, we can do this. I reckon this squad were going to make a dent in Europe. I thought we were equipped to go to make a dent in the Champions League. We were unlucky the previous season. We got 9 points. So of course we wanted to actually go into the Champions League again. So we turned up against Christian Gross's Basel, and the Celtic view that's from that week, I'll hold up here. It's got Chris Sutton on the front looking green, mean and moody.
Oh, very, very nice.
That's the Celtic View photographer done well that day. I mean, if Chris was looking for a photo for the next back of his book, that's it there, eh? That's the one that he should do, is he?
Or that's actually the album I went for later, I think. It's Chris Sutton's Greatest Hits I went for, Kev. You know what I mean? That could be the front cover.
It's very George Michael, isn't it? It is very George Michael. Anyway, they're saying in this game that Celtic wanted to play Vilnius, who Basel had put out. I remember going to this game full of confidence. And within 4 minutes, within 2 minutes, we were 1-0 down. What do you remember about that night, Russell?
Loads. I was so deflated. It was unbelievable. I think, like you, we felt there was a real unjust about our exit in the Champions League. Obviously, you start, you know, splitting hairs and you go, that Nicola Maruso dive basically cost us a place in the next round. 9 points was more points than we expected to get in the group the year before. It was a really, really good achievement. And I couldn't wait to get back in the Champions League. I think as well, it was mixing it with the big boys again. It felt really, it was quite amazing. That was the era, you know, you were talking about Didier Gatta, a press conference in that first Champions League campaign. And O'Neill was saying he was a £29 million player back then. And that was, you know, 20 years ago, you know. And I thought the FC Basel, very much like yourself, good draw, comfy draw. We'll deal with them, no bother at all. And like you say, right from the, you know, the first 5 minutes, boom, brought back to reality. And actually, what transpired that night was actually symptomatic of a lot of Celtic away performances, particularly in that competition, over the next, well, you could see even up to now almost, you know, you could argue. And I always, you know, I remember we were all taken aback, and I think it just shows you can never underestimate the champions of another country too easily. Do you know what I mean? You can't do that.
The scouting report in that Celtic View says that they were a very handy side. And when you look at their squad, they were an experienced side. They had guys who had played in Turkey, had guys that had played in Germany. I think it's typical of maybe the Scottish arrogance when you don't know the name of the team, you just go, oh, we should beat them. We've never heard of them and it's going to be easy. And that turned out not to be the case that night. So Martin O'Neill lined up with his normal 3-5-2 that night. So you had Big Rab and goals, Johan, Bald, Bobo, Big Hughes, Momo Sauer, Lennon, Lambert, who was replaced by Jackie Mackey after 77 minutes, Stan Petroff, Bobby Petter, who was replaced with Steve Guppy in 56 minutes, Sutton and Larson up front. Now,
so the line of I'm looking at says Ulrich Larson was playing.
That's the away leg. That's the away leg that we're going to get to.
Right.
That's Ulrich Larson played in the away leg. So that's a home leg. Now, when you look at the goal that we lost after 2 minutes, it's an absolute horror show by both Bobo Baldy and Hughes Valhan. And the boy, what's his name, Christian Jimenez, sort of miskicks the ball and it ends up trickling into the net. I remember being in the stadium that night and the stadium went silent as soon as that goal went in. We were like, oh no, here we go. And when you actually have a look back at that time, I think that was the moment I sort of realised that Ulrich Larson, we'll come to speak about him later on, Big Valhan was a liability at that level. He wasn't as good. I think injuries had a lot to play with as well at that level. But when you see a couple of goals that we've lost round about that time, and on the run to Seville as well, which happened after this, you go, Big Valhan was not the best.
I would argue, though, as well, I felt a wee bit sorry for him because he always seemed to play in the left of the three. And I never really thought he was as comfortable playing on the left of the three centre-halves. You know what I mean, Kev? Mm. I always thought, they're all predominantly right-footed. And I think you're looking at me, Albie and Bobo, and going, they're definitely not playing on the left-hand side of the three. And I kind of felt he was maybe just... We definitely could have been doing with a left-sided centre-back, which I'm guessing was why then Lewerson was brought in to sort of give that balance. Because I did feel... I think you're right, Valhan probably wasn't as good in the long run as what he was that first season. The first season, I mean, he was... Something else, to be fair. We looked like we got a snap. Remember, he'd had an amazing Euros before we'd signed him for Belgium. He'd looked right good player as well. Mm-hmm. And he lived up to that first season. And then I think the second year, he just, once the level's gone up against opposition, like you rightfully point out, and you put him at the left of a three, it was a tough gig for him at times, wasn't it?
I think a lot of the times playing in the back three in Europe, we were exposed because our wing-backs played higher up the pitch. And O'Neill tried to sort this in the return leg by going to a back four in the away leg with Ulrich Larson going to left back and Johan Mjalby at right back. Now, not the most two mobile full-backs that you'll ever get in your life there, eh? But we'll get to the away leg after this. So Henrik Larsson pulls us back into the game after, I think it was 4 minutes again. So they score, we equalise, a quick equaliser. So game's back on. Chris Sutton ends up 54th minute, puts us 2-1 up. But bottom line was, Bal were the better team that night. Bal played us off the park. And even at 2-1, we were lucky to be 2-1 up because Bal were impressing all over the pitch. The two Yakin brothers.
Hakan, and
Murat Hakan were impressing. They had the couple of wee Argentinians that played for them as well, the goal scorer Jimenez. They were a quick, pacey side who were well coached, well drilled, and knew what they were good at. And I remember being completely surprised by the quality that they actually possessed.
But again, I think you've just summed it all up. That's because in the eyes of the Scottish media or you know, the Scottish football fan in general, we've never heard of this mob. They must be rubbish. They'll get a tonking. I mean, the Yakin brothers really stand out for me. I think if my homework says Murat Yakin by then was in his second spell at Bale. I think he'd been to Turkey, I think he might have played in, or Germany. And then he came back to Bale. So he was then vastly experienced centre-half, the captain. And I remember Hakan Yakin just being outstanding. But he just ticked all the boxes. He looked a fantastic player. I know we'll touch on the away leg, but I remember his through ball in the away leg, the reverse slide rule pass was just outstanding, out of this world. And you know, it was two South Americans they had up top, wasn't it?
I can't remember
the name of the other one.
Oh,
no, I'm not sure.
Come to us.
And I remember they'd done something like they were saying, obviously the commentators wait for you to be getting, you know, humped in the middle of the match before they start going, Jimenez scored 30 goals last year for Bale. And they're like, nobody mentioned that, you know, in the build-up to the game. They were a very handy side. And they had a decent keeper as well. We'd made a couple of good stops over the two legs as well, from what I've looked into as well, and from what I remember. I think, Kev, you're right. We were taken aback, but that was, you know, that's just our ignorance to it. And, you know, you deserve to be taken aback if you don't actually, you know, do your research, you know what I mean?
Definitely. And I would like Celtic had done their reset. Another Argentinian striker was Julio Rossi. Rosso.
Yes.
Julio Rossi. Now, I'm having a look at the scouting report here, and it was the scout's name? John. Well, it was Stephen Sullivan that wrote the piece in the article, and it was John O'Hare who went to watch Bale, and he says that Murat Yakin was very similar to Alan Stubbs, taking the ball forward and playing long raking passes. I just remember him being a brilliant, decent defender who scored in the return leg as well. But it looked like he should have been in a Def Leppard tribute band. He had that sort of wannabe like Shaggy Perm type thing. No, not like yours. Yours is far better than that. But this was one of the nights where Europe, We had built ourselves up that much for getting into the Champions League, getting a bit of a tonking, even though we were 2-1 up at the time, off the Swiss champions was somewhat an eye-opener for us. It was maybe a leveler bringing her back to earth. Then Didier Raya's replacement that night was a guy called Momo Sylla. Now, I've says his name, and I'm sure everybody that's watching us in the comments has got the Momo Sylla song going through their heads. And you want to get it out your head all night now that we're going to talk about Momo. Sylla had came into that side because Didier Agat was injured and he was playing as the right wing back. The game before, we had bet Aberdeen 4-0 the game before, and he had a great game. He scored. What I remember about this night as well, he was absolutely fantastic as well on the right hand side. He was a maverick type player. He didn't know what he was going to do.
He didn't know what he was going to do next at times as well. I think he had that. I'll give you a wee comparison. Different position, right? But a bit of Kanu about him. Kind of that way, once he'd started dribbling by a couple of players, he just thought, well, I'll turn that way. But it was a mad sort of style he had about him. But I think Sylla was that bad for us over the piece. I mean, he was never going to be a first-team starter week in, week out, was he, Kev? You know what I mean?
There was a lot of... I mean, what was his best position? If you were playing him on the right-hand side, you had Didier Agat. So he wasn't going to get a game there. If you played him up front, Martin O'Neill actually says that he saw him playing behind the two strikers. And we're going to get to that later on. Martin O'Neill says he saw him playing behind the two strikers. I think he was like a snake in a sack, eh? He didn't care where he was going to go. I need to watch what I'm saying, eh? So he didn't care what he was going to do with the ball. But it was... Henrik Larsson that night as well, before Silla scored in the 88th minute. Henrik Larsson missed a penalty as well.
That's right.
In that game, eh? He had it straight down. He hit it straight down the middle, and the keeper's hit the keeper's leg. Now that was the second penalty kick Henrik had missed for Celtic in a European tie in a row, because he had missed Valencia. The penalty kick and missed the penalty kick in the shootout against Valencia as well. And he would also go on to miss one later on in the season against Boa Vista at home. Penalty kick. So you're going, Henrik Larsson, for being an utter best player I've ever seen playing for Celtic. There was a couple of times where, when you actually look back at these two legs, he missed quite a few guilty chances, and especially in the away leg. And Bao was not his best European game for Celtic anyway.
No, I think that's fair. Just to touch on the Henrik's misses, I think that's what made... He was so relatable, though. He was one of these guys, even though you knew he's like a god, he was one of those folk who you knew he wasn't invincible. He could miss penalties. He did miss the odd opportunity, but he was someone that nothing ever stopped Henrik, do you know what I mean, coming back for more. And that's what I love about him, you know. And for all the missed penalties and that, he's still the one who got the important goals into that UEFA Cup run against, you know, Blackburn, Liverpool, home legs, you know, obviously the semi-final, you know, the winner. I mean, he was one of those folk, it never stopped him, it never put him off. It just, if anything, I always used to find, you know, you hear all this nonsense about idiots like Morelos, about he plays on the edge. I mean, he's playing on the edge, he's better. Henrik Larsson, actually, I used to find, once he got a wee bit of a bee in his bonnet, once he got wound up about something, because he's an amazing temperament, but I used to think Henrik was better when he was just a wee bit cheesed off about something. And whether that be a miss by him, or whether that be something said by English media, or anything like that, I used to feel that Henrik Larsson was always at his best when he did play slightly on what his equivalent of the edge is. Do you know what I mean? I always used to think I used to bring out the best in him.
He always seemed to play better. If we go further on into this season, he always seemed to play better when he had a bit of anger, when he had something to prove.
That's what I'm trying to say.
See Blackburn, see the Boa Vista away leg after he had missed the penalty at Celtic Park.
That's what I'm saying. Exactly, Kev, because it's two examples of that there. One was his fault and he was wound up. One was other people.
This week on The Marketer's Report, Patrizio Spagnoletto, Global Chief Marketing Officer, Direct-to-Consumer for Warner Brothers Discovery, weighs in on building trust.
Trust is a really hard thing to build and a really easy thing to destroy, and we have to be very respectful about that. Our partnership with iHeart has really helped us build that trust and that relationship with the on-air talent.
As the number one audio company, iHeartMedia gives you access to all, every audience, live conversations, trusted influencers, and the data you need to grow. Go to iHeartResults.com for more. This week on The Marketer's Report, Patrizio Spagnoletto, Global Chief Marketing Officer, Direct-to-Consumer for Warner Brothers Discovery, weighs in on building trust.
Trust is a really hard thing to build and a really easy thing to destroy, and we have to be very respectful about that. Our partnership with iHeart has really helped us build that trust and that relationship with the on-air talent.
As the number one audio company, iHeartMedia gives you access to all, every audience, live conversations, trusted influencers, and the data you need to grow. Go to iHeartResults.com for more.
Well, doubting him and that wound him up, but you're spot on, sorry.
No, it's fine. Zinko says in the comments, God, now that you say that, his penalties for a while were a bit dodgy. But the end of that season, Alan Thompson was taking the penalties, and that didn't work out well for us either. I think they're still looking for that ball at Rugby Park, actually. I'm not 100% sure. So, 88th minute, I thought this goal had took us through. Momo Silla half volley, the place went absolutely ballistic. The place went mental. And it's a fantastic goal by Momo Silla. And it was one of those you've got, he's one of those that you're leaving the ground going, two goal comfort, brilliant. I fancy us to score across there because they'll need to come out a bit more. And at the back of the mind, it's a false arrogance, I reckon, I left the ground with that night thinking back. I thought, we've got a two goal cushion. I fancy our chances to score. I mean, you've got Sutton and Larsson up front. Of course you're going to fancy your chances to score. And we've got two goals. We've got a two-goal cushion. I reckon that we could have got through. I was quite confident of getting through into the next round. And when you're looking at Silla that night, you're going, we could have a player there. We could have a guy who could contribute. to that squad that season, because we wanted to get into the Champions. We wanted to get into the Champions League. I mean, you've got to remember at this point the Champions League had two group stages, so there was like 12 games. That you had
you needed a squad, 100%.
So you were going to need your squad, and we went away going like that. Right, two goal advantage. This team's handy, but I reckon we've got the measure of them.
Do you know what? I remember thinking it was complete relief. I felt like we got away with one.
Do you think so?
I felt we'd got away with one by that last goal. I thought that papered over the cracks a bit, but like you, was confident now we've got the two-goal cushion, we'll go there and we'll be jamming. Do you know what I mean? I did think that as well, but I've got to be honest, I remember that game. That it was like you said, there was just a few shaky moments through it where you thought, this isn't going. And again, maybe it's tempered with the fact, though, that you had such an expectancy. You were so expected. We were expecting 3-0, let's be honest. And a comfortable night's work. And to got the 3-1, I remember at the time, I was about 14, just approaching 15, and thinking at that age, going, 3-1, like, we should be fine.
I'm getting what you're saying there, eh? We got away with it, but we had the arrogance of how good that team was, the talent that we had in that side. What we were saying was, we can't be as bad again going away from home. So we're going to Switzerland in 2 weeks' time with a two-goal lead, and you've got one of the best strikers in the world up front. We are going to score an away goal. And I remember being extremely confident on the day of the game. And this is a funny thing. These two ties weren't shown. Nowadays, these ties would have been shown on BT Sport. Celtic TV showed both of these ties. You had to subscribe to Celtic TV, and it was on the Sky platform. So it was.
I'm sure one was on BBC.
Positive. The away leg was definitely on Celtic TV. It was definitely on Celtic TV because Celtic made a big deal about buying the rights for this away game. And you had to subscribe because Celtic had showed quite a few pre-season friendlies on. You used to get it through a Sky channel. I think I can even remember the Sky channel. It was Sky Channel 435. That was the Celtic TV channel, eh? And so you subscribed on it. You pressed your wee red button and it took it off your bank, and that was it. And so I remember getting all the lads doing, and my family, my dad and all of that, doing to the house to watch the second leg, thinking, ah, here we go, we're going to get into the Champions League again. This is where we want to be. This is going to be great. Now, just when I was hanging that there, Celtic had announced that they had signed a travel partnership with 67 Travel, and I used to go to the European away games in this time, so in my head I always remember I never paid more than £200 for a day trip or an overnight stay, right? I think it was with Harry Hines or whoever it was. So the official trip with Celtic with 67 Travel, I'll spit it up here, £365 for an overnight stay. And I was going, that's extortionate. That's absolutely extortionate.
Is that flinging in a day at the Alps as well? What's the score there?
What does it say? Two days, one night, three-star accommodations, transfers plus match ticket. Now, Celtic only had 800 tickets that night. So there would have been a lot of guys who that would have been their only reason to actually get a ticket. What's even funnier, just now I've actually seen that, as the Celtic view of how they've got a wee thing where they've got youth development role of honour. That's a bit strange, eh? Anyway.
I don't mind that, though.
I just, when I looked at it, when I was putting that down there, I was like, role of honour. There we go.
All right.
So we go to the away leg, and Martin O'Neill goes to a 4-4-2. Melby right-back, Urlich Ross left-back. We got absolutely slaughtered in the first half. We weren't at the races. We were 2-0 down after 22 minutes. We were all across the shop. And I remember sitting watching it going, what's happening here? But still having that confidence in ourselves. We've got Henrik Larsson. We're going to score. We're going to score. Larson should have scored just after they scored their first. He had an easy chance with a header. Bobo Baldy should have scored just after we went 2-0 down. But we're going at half time, and you're like, we've still got 45 minutes left. 45 minutes, game's all square, we score, it's fine. At half time, Martin O'Neill brings on, who did he bring on? Let's have a look. So the team in the second leg, I never read the team. The team in the second leg were Douglas, Johan, Baldy, Hughes, Lawson. Guppy came on for him at half time.
Yeah.
Silla, John Hartson came on for Momo Silla in 71 minutes. Lennon, Lambert, who was taken off for Didier Agaf at half time as well, when Celtic went back to a 3-5-2.
Mm-hmm.
Petrov, Sutton, and Henrik. So with a 4-4-2. So you would have had Silla on the left-hand side, Petrov on the right. That's the way, I can't really remember it, but having a read of that team, that's the way I sort of worked it out. But the second half, we didn't batter them, but we completely controlled the game. We had chances by Baldy, Larson, then you had the one in the final minute by Chris Sutton, who the curler at the back post, where it looked for all intents and purposes it was in, and you've ended up with that famous picture of Martin O'Neill on his knees as he watches it, as he actually watches the ball going, by the post, and final whistle goes, and we're out the Champions League, and I remember like going, that's our season finished.
Yep.
This was the only goal that we wanted. After having a taste of the Champions League, we wanted to get back into the Champions League. And I can remember being utterly gutted, probably more gutted than I have been this season, that we didn't get into the Champions League that season.
I agree with you. I think you're making the point really well. I mean, what I love about the character of that team, though, and obviously that came from the manager first and foremost, but he also did sign a team of men then, Kev, do you know what I mean? And one thing that always happened, they always settled their scores. That's always felt about that team. They always settled their scores, and it's like that once they'd realised they'd blown an amazing opportunity, a kind draw, you have to say, on paper it was anyway, but what they did was that they just got the bit between their teeth, didn't they? And we all know what happened on the road to Seville after that, you know, and that was very much like, remember that season, we lost the league obviously on the last day, and then the next year we won it by like 20 points because we always, like it was like we were so determined because they'd lost it that year before. It was the next season, just when I was just punishing everyone. Do you know what I mean? Taking it out on the, it was such a great way to channel. That team had such an amazing way of channeling its inner frustrations or inner anger at, you know, at knockbacks and setbacks that they went through. And, you know, the Basel result, you know, was obviously, as you say, I couldn't agree more. It was like, what's going on here? This is a disaster. But it was the catalyst in pushing these guys on to levels we've not seen since in Europe.
It's a great point, and we're probably doing Bale a bit of a disservice here, because Bale got drawn into a group with Liverpool, Valencia and Spartak Moscow and finished second in the group behind Valencia and knocked out Liverpool and ended up getting into the next group stage. In the next group stage, they faced Man United, Juve and Deportivo. Man United and Juve qualified for the group, but Bale still got 7 points in their second group stage. And three big leagues in Europe. They were a decent side.
So the key question is, Kev, flip it. Celtic do qualify and are in those groups at that time. How would they have done?
We're beating Liverpool. I mean, we beat them later on in the season.
So they're beating Liverpool.
We've actually got that's an evidence based answer. That's
an evidence based answer. Well, we'd already faced Valencia in the February before and had bet them at Celtic Park, and
we were more than a match for them.
We would have had a good chance of getting out that group. When you get to the next one and you've got Man United, Juve and Deportivo,
I'd have fancied us.
Would you?
Honest truth. I think that season, they were just all at the right age as well. They weren't like 28, 29. You know, when people talk about coming into their peak, a lot of that squad were 30, 31, 32, some of them. And they were streetwise. And they were also still at a level where the legs hadn't remotely gone at all. I can't think of any of them that I had. They were all in great nick for that age, streetwise, and they all played for each other. I just think it's just a wee what if, and we're like a rabbit hole on this show, Kev. You know that yourself. So
definitely,
just interesting if you flip the scenarios, could Celtic actually go out of those two? And I tell you what, Celtic qualifying for the last 16 under Strachan twice wouldn't have came close to if we'd got out two groups, I think, in the Champions League. For me, that's an unbelievable achievement to do over 12 games at that level. You know, that's a real acid test.
Having to play 12 games in the Champions League is a strain on any squad. And I think we might have paid the price. I think the 12 games might have been too much for the team to get out the two group stages at that side. But then,
big Momo Salah would have been ripping up the Premier League, mate.
Well, let's talk about Momo. I mean, he played really well in the first game against Bill. He got man of the match in the quarter final against Liverpool at Anfield.
I knew you were going to say that.
So the big fella done well for us. There's I'm going to ask you a question though. I'm going to actually rewind back to that night in Switzerland. Do you know who the referee was?
Swedish?
He was Swedish.
Hair slightly blonder than mine.
Yes, he was. And Andras Frisk was
the rival to Kalina, wasn't he? In terms of, they were the two big names, weren't they?
The celebrity referees.
That's a good way of putting it.
Refs. He never gave us a penalty kick that night when the ball defender handled the ball in the box. The ball defender collapsed in the box and put his hand on the ball. We should have got a penalty kick that night. And I've never liked Andras Frisk since that. Kalina was always the better ref.
Oh, aye. 100%. By miles. Absolutely.
You would have crapped yourself with Kalina, eh?
If you, with that stare. 100%.
Another strange fact which links to the modern-day Celtic.
Okay.
Kristen Gross was the manager of Bow that night, failed Tottenham manager. Ramon Vegan's manager as well, yes. He recently got a job after a long time out of football with Schalke, and he's recently been sacked by Schalke. Yeah. And who's going to take over at Schalke?
Ralph Rangnick,
a name that a lot of the Celtic fans have been wanting it as Celtic manager. Now, Schalke are doomed. They're going to the Bundesliga 2 next year. There's no way anybody's saving them. And it's a case of what if, eh? Have we asked Rangnick the question? Or Schalke are a massive club. Let's not kid ourselves on here.
No.
Even though they're going to be in the Bundesliga 2, Schalke are a massive club, massive backing, massive fan base. So for somebody that's been based in Germany, it could be a no-brainer. Maybe he always knew he was going to get that role at Schalke. Maybe we'll have to ask the question.
I definitely think that if he's took the job at Schalke, though, then he's definitely open to a variety of challenges and isn't someone who's just got a stereotype of the club that he sees himself being at, or a certain level, shall we say, or, you know, in a certain league. I think it's all the more frustrating if he's went there and we've not asked the question, because he seems to me, if he's willing, although I'm not sure if Paul John Dyke's quashed us today on a Celtic state of mind, by the way. Apparently it might not be happening now, but anyway. But if it does happen, Ah, there we go.
Oh, there he is. He's came in. Schalke has
I thought he'd just done like that today.
Mm.
But I think if he is to get that job, then definitely it would give you an insight into, you know, what he's like in terms of his approachability. And I think certainly he may well have been someone that was more within our grasp than we maybe believed. I don't know. If we have asked him the question, he's Joe Schalke, fair enough, though.
I would like to think that we had asked him the question. We'll never know if we asked him the question unless he came out and says it.
No.
But we'll move on for that ball game. But one question. I mean, we could talk about the Seville wall, and we probably will do a Seville run special at one point. Would you swap beating Bow for what happened?
No.
Nah, you wouldn't, you know. If somebody would have told you when that final whistle went and Bow, what was going to happen, you would have went, I'm happy with that. You would have been happy with that. Eh? And it's a strange what if, because when you say, oh, imagine going into a group with Valencia, Liverpool, then going into a group with Juve and Man United, that would have been great. But then we wouldn't have had Blackburn, we wouldn't have had Boa Vista, we wouldn't have had Stuttgart, we wouldn't have had 80,000 fans in Seville. So it's difficult, but I'm like you. I wouldn't change it in the world.
No, but what I would say, just for balance, and I can under, you know, I don't think any Celtic fan would change that amazing time, you know, for anything. If that means taking a defeat over two legs to Bow, then it's a small price to pay for what happened. But the only thing I would flip it with is, who was stopping us in Europe that year, you know? The only team that stopped us was the team that became European champions themselves the year later. That's it, you know, that speaks volumes. I know maybe the quality of, no, I'm still, we played some strong teams. I think Celtic that year in Europe, the Bow result went against the grain. I think we could have made a big dent in that Champions League that year as well. But no, I wouldn't swap it, no. But I don't think it would have been doom and gloom if we'd qualified for the Champions League either. I think it could have been a really quite exciting time.
Not equally, but it's one of these things that you're glad that it happened. Really.
It's the smallest place to bake it, if you know what I mean.
A
defeat over two legs on aggregate, and you pay that price and you get, you know, just what was just such a memorable, incredible season.
The way I think about it was, I remember sitting at my work's desk at the office, being utterly depressed the day after we got put out with Bow. Then I remember the morning after Boa Vista trying to book flights to Seville, and the two different emotions sitting at the same desk was unbelievable. And I never want to forget that. I never want to forget that feeling. And that's why we watch football, to get those sort of feelings. In the Celtic view as well, obviously, Lubo, we spoke about Lubo at quite great length a week ago. Lubo retired, and everybody was going.
As the number one audio company, iHeartMedia gives you access to all, every audience, live conversations, trusted influencers, and the insights and data you need to grow. iHeartMedia is your access company. Go to iHeartResults.com for more.
Who's going to replace Lubo? So Martin O'Neill, in this interview in the Celtic View here, says there was already three guys in the Celtic squad who could possibly replace Lubo Maravchuk. One was Momo Sylla, who we've already spoke about. Martin says that he saw him, even though he was playing at right wing back, he saw him behind the two strikers. Now, second was Sean Maloney, who at that point was breaking into the team. He was, as soon as he broke into the side, he was deemed the sorcerer's apprentice because he was a wee hobbit-like, kind of the same sort of diminutive stature as Lubo. And another player that Martin O'Neill fancied in that role, we had signed for Livingston that summer, David Fernandez. David Fernandez is one of the guys who, he always looked to me like that wee tubby boy at school who did the Ken who his dad was,
because he's in the wrong movie.
He didn't know. He just looked out of place wherever he went. I mean, we may as well start off with David Fernandez. I mean, David Fernandez signed for Airdrie when Steve Archibald was the manager at Airdrie.
Yeah. There was Garcia San Juan, Calderon. There's a few of them.
Aye. So, having Steve Archibald as your manager and all these Spaniards turning up, no wonder they were liquidated. No wonder they got into financial bother. So Fernandez ended up going to Livingston, and in Livingston's debut season in the Premier League, he scored quite a few goals, and Celtic signed him on the same day that they signed Marcus Hedman and Urlik Larsson. So that was, so Celtic signed him for £1 million. So that's quite a big signing, eh? It never really happened for him. If you look at the players that were in front of him, you had Larsson, Sutton, Hartson all in front of him. The midfield, you had Lennon, Lambert, Petrov all in front of him. And he just didn't really seem to take off. No, I think he was talented. I think he had ability. I think you saw that at Livingston. But I never really thought he was Celtic's class.
I think he was one of those players that was needed to be the talisman of his team, the maverick. I think his actual natural gifted ability was outstanding, to be fair. I think he had all the techers, and I'm sure in training he did some things that would have made them all sort of sit back and take notice. But to be in that Celtic team at that time, it took so much more than that. You had to really be part of the ethos that the rest of those guys had. And for me, a lot of that came down to graft. A lot of it came down to strength, desire, and all the stuff Stephen Pressley talks about, to be fair. But a lot of the characteristics and the makeup of that team, I don't think David Fernandez had. But I think he had ability, yes. But I think he had to be the main man at what team he was at. Certainly not someone who was in and out, because I agree with you. I'm not saying he was unfit, but he certainly looked like he was probably, maybe not as match sharp as the rest, to say the least. But definitely in terms of natural ability, I'm sure it was quite a coup they got him. I can't remember whose youth side he set up, but I should have checked that out, because
Deportivo.
It was Deportivo. I knew it was one of them, and they were at that time, though, remember. They didn't win the Champions League 1 year. Although they won La Liga, I beg your pardon, in 2001, I think.
Mm-hmm.
So he came from a good school. Do you know what I mean? A proper good school.
He did that. And Stuart Horan actually says, overall, good player. He never seemed like, as you talk about the personality in that dressing room, he didn't seem like the type of guy who would have the personality to stand out in that dressing room.
No.
As proved, when he got a UEFA Cup runners-up medal, he was on the bench that night in Seville, and that summer we actually loaned him back to Livingston. He then went to Dundee United and Kilmarnock, and he scored against us. He scored 5 goals for Dundee United, and I'm sure 2 of them were against us at Celtic Park when Dundee United beat us. I probably should have checked that. Do you know what he's doing now?
Oh, no, I love this stuff. I love when you do this. Go for it.
He's a scout for Manchester City.
You're joking.
Nope. He's been a scout for Manchester City since 2012, since he gave up playing. So, there you go. There's another Man City connection, as we spoke about many Man City connections yesterday.
I should have got that, eh?
He's a scout for Manchester City. So that's us got Paddy Vieira, Craig Bellamy, and David Fernandez as head scout. We've got it sorted, man. We've got it sorted. So we'll go back to Momo Sylla, who was another one earmarked to play that role. Sylla was he was raised in Paris, and Gikeni's been capped for both the Ivory Coast and Guinea. He played half a dozen times for the Ivory Coast in friendlies then played competitively for Guinea.
For Guinea, aye. Yep.
So we signed him in 2001 for St Johnstone. I remember him. He was a bit like Fernandez at St Johnstone. Well, it was Fernandez at Livingston.
He was the man.
He was the main man. When you watched him on the telly, he stood out like a seer from as being the shining light in the dung heap that was round about him. And he was fantastic. At this time, when we're talking about that time in August, he was a rich vein of form for us. He was in a fantastic vein of form. So it makes you wonder, where did it all go wrong? But as some people in the comments have already says, one week he was a 10 out of 10. Next week he was a 1 out of 10. And he seemed to come on like League Cup games when O'Neill was rotating the squad, and he would always do well. But he just could never get into the... Again, it's the quality of the first 11 in front of him. And a lot of these players, we remember them as hits or misses, but then they weren't getting the run on the side basically because of the quality that was there in that first 11.
And I think Martin, he was very rigid as well in terms of that. He wasn't wanting to make 4 or 5 changes for a league game and stuff. You know, he was very, and I'm sure there's examples of where he did, but my memory of him anyway was O'Neill had his favourites, if you want to call it that, but justifiably so, by the way, in a lot of their cases. It was a really, really tough nut to crack to get into that team back then. It really was. And for Momo Sylla going up against someone like Didier Agat, who Martin O'Neill's, as I touched on earlier, was quoting at the £29 million price tag and stuff like that on his head. I mean, it's going to be tricky. That if O'Neill's rating you that highly, and I'm sure there was one, you know, his tongue was in his cheek, but it was also an insight into just how good a player Martin O'Neill thought Didier Agat was. For Momo Sylla to really take that place on regularly from the day I got, would have took a colossal effort, I think.
Definitely, and he always seemed a bit of a loose cannon. Kevin Banks in the comments says, "I also remember the footage of Momo when he was in court for speeding or something, and he swaggered into the court wearing a shirt with Public Enemy on it, with the Public Enemy logo on it. It would suit a Celtic state of mind. We should try and get him on for a wee interview. Actually, I think Momo would have. Did he not get? I know he got racially abused at Aberdeen." In the game before the Bow game, but did he not get racially abused at St Johnstone as well when he played for Celtic, and that ended up at court? I'm not 100% sure. I'm not 100% sure about that, but I might be wrong. But I liked Momo. He just didn't. He was never getting in that side. He left us, and strangely enough, went to Leicester. When Craig Levein took, took Rab Douglas and Momo Sylla to Leicester from us as well, and he ended up going back to St Johnstone. And I don't know what he's doing now. He's maybe working for Man City in some sort of capacity.
Probably.
if anybody in the comments can tell us what Momo Sylla's doing now, let us know. Now, the third one that Martin spoke up in this article was Sean Maloney. Maloney broke into O'Neill's side at that point, but again, he had the same problem as Fernandez and Sylla. The number of bodies in front of him, the number of good players in front of him to try and get into the side. But I think it was noticeable from early on that Maloney was a better player than Sylla and Fernandez, without a doubt. He had the talent, but all three of these players are no Martin O'Neill type players, eh?
When
you actually think about it, they're not Martin O'Neill type players when you look at O'Neill's Leicester side and the first 11 at Celtic. And I think that didn't benefit Maloney when he was trying to get game time as a young teenager breaking into the squad as well. What was your... Obviously, everybody remembers Maloney coming on at Ibrox, and you're going, who's this wee guy? But for me, I always remember Sean Maloney, Gordon Strachan's first season. That's when Maloney really came into his own. And by that point, he's 21, 22. O'Neill, he had got a bad cruciate ligament injury in 2004 and basically missed a year, and Celtic gave him a 3-year contract. He came back for Gordon Strachan, and you've got to remember, everybody thought Gordon Strachan. Everybody thought Maloney was either going to go to Aberdeen or Livingston before he impressed Gordon Strachan in training.
That's right.
And that season, he became the player and the young player of the year in Scotland. For me, that's peak Sean Maloney before the injuries got hold. He came on in the Seville season. He scored against Stuttgart in that Seville run.
That's my first memory of him.
He scored against Stuttgart. He came on an extra time in Seville and blundered a free kick over the bar. So this is really weird. Those three players have all got runners-up medal for Seville. You wouldn't think that.
It's not bad going, is it?
That's no bad going for guys who, especially under O'Neill, did they really do much. I loved Maloney as a player. He always knew Sean Maloney as a footballer. He had a touch, and the way that he could, an eye for goal, an eye for a pass. He was always
great. He was smart.
He was football intelligence. And I remember being utterly gutted when he, strangely, bizarrely, after the way he was treated with Martin O'Neill for 5 years, joined Martin O'Neill at Aston Villa for £1 million.
I know.
I remember that move going, he never played you. Why are you going to... Why are you going down to a manager who struggles to fit you in his side? Which for me. He soon came back. Maybe it shows you how no bad Celtic were run at that point, eh? But we sold him for £1 million and bought him back for 2.8.
Madness, eh? That is madness, Kev.
That is absolute madness. Again, Sean's career followed a strange path, the same path. Broke into the side, done well, got injured. Came back from injury. Started the season, done well, got injured. Came back from injury, started the next season, started brilliantly, got injured, came back for injury. And he'd done that under Gordon Strachan twice, Mowbray and Lennon. Then it was basically Neil Lennon replaced him with Chris Commons because the injuries. I think Maloney, I know Laura, who contributes to the site as well, she doesn't like the way Maloney left us for Aston Villa. I don't think I've really got a... I like the fact that he came back. He was such a talented player. And he scored one of the best goals I've seen, but one of the best Scotland goals I've seen at Celtic Park, Scotland Love against that. Ireland. Absolute peachy goal. What's your memories of Sean?
My first memory was always... I think when you look back as well with the O'Neill thing, it's quite interesting, Kev, what you're saying there about he struggled to fit him in. My memory growing up was Maloney was very much fourth-choice striker. Now, for me, Sean Maloney is not a striker. When you think of all the years that panned out after that, Sean Maloney was not an out-and-out striker. But that was the only way O'Neill could obviously get him. But O'Neill obviously did rate him, because you talk about that goal against Stuttgart. I know I mentioned it the other week. I said, I think he had a bit. That's where I thought he's got a bit about him. But Martin O'Neill, at that point, had spent £1 million on David Fernandez. Martin O'Neill was playing... could have easily brought someone else into the midfield and just had, you know, played Sutton Hartson up front and then like someone else in the hole, do you know what I mean? But instead he went for Maloney as a, you know, as a forward. I mean, we're all worried. And he scored. And I think that showed that as much as O'Neill, maybe we're struggling from the outside to see if he liked him or he rated him or he played him a lot. There must have been a bit of a bond there between the two of them, because, you know, for him to go to Villa. There must have been. And then there is wee hints and examples, like Stuttgart in particular for me, where you go, well, he did rate him, because that was his go-to guy when Henrik was out. You know, he picked Sean Maloney for what was a crunch game at that stage, because we knew we're doing all right here, we're in with a chance. That was an unlike O'Neill risk to take unless he, you know, had convictions that, No, Sean Maloney will be able to do it against them. But yeah, I think he evolved as a player, didn't he? I didn't think the striker role He's not an out-and-out. He's not a number nine, is he? Let's be honest. It's not his position. He's someone for me that I think was more creative than a finisher. But I've got a lot. I mean, the Scotland goal does stand out as well. I'm glad that you put that one up there. But I actually think you two, did you win the FA Cup with Wigan?
He did win the FA Cup with Wigan, yes.
He had a really good spell there as well. Mm-hmm. And, you know, when he came back for his second spell, you've got to be honest, we were excited when he was coming back. Because you knew the level of experience he had been there at Aston Villa, he was going to come back a better player for it. And he was one of the sort of headline signings that summer.
I mean, he won the FA Cup with Wigan, but I'm also sure, did he not play in the FA Cup final with Hull City as well? I might be
wrong there,
but yeah.
I think you've got a shout there.
Because he went to America, then he came back and played for Hull City. He seems a very sporty guy. Obviously, he's got a high-rated job with Belgium now. He also played cricket and tennis to quite a high level as well. And he used to play tennis with Andy Murray, when he was a young lad. So that shows you the level of all-round sporting ability that he has. It'll be interesting to see if he's got any part to play in Celtic's immediate future. Celtic Rambler on the comments says, Mo Salah runs an English-based soap company these days. I don't know whether that's true or no. I think it would be. Hopefully it is true, because that would be quite an interesting angle to get an interview with him. Russell, it's 56 minutes and we need to start talking about music. 56 minutes. We've done it again. So, right. On the week of the 11th of August, that's when the charts were out on the first Ball game. So I've based this on the first Ball game. At number one in the Hit Parade, we'll go smashy and nicey here. Number one in the Hit Parade was Colourblind by Bears Den's best crooner since Frank Sinatra, Darius. What reality show did Darius win?
None.
Or what one was he in?
He was in two.
Was he in two?
He got rejected for one, and then he went on the other one. I remember at the time, man. So I think he'd been on Fame Academy, and then I think he went on to Pop Idol. I think he came third or fourth in Pop Idol.
Was Pop Idol no called Pop Stars at that point?
I don't think so, man.
Anyway, whatever one that he went on, he finished behind Will Young and Gareth Gates. Whatever one it was.
Pop Idol.
Right. So that was number one in the charts. At number 10 in the charts is a song which didn't actually make much of a dent on me at the time, but 2002, so 14 years later, actually made a dent on me. It was Scooter with a Logical song.
Brilliant.
So obviously, the Logical song became absolutely famous when the Green Brigade turned it in the Scotty Sinclair song.
Yes.
So I was just looking at that going, the Logical song. That's one of the Green Brigade's finest moments, coming up with that song for Scotty Sinclair.
I think we're getting told he was on Pop Stars and Pop Idol. We were both half right, Kev. It wouldn't have done much for our street cred if we were both spot on, would it?
I thought that was the same programme. Maybe 100%. I thought it was the same programme. So, in the album charts, Ewan Boy Martin says, wasn't Darius a Celtic fan? Google didn't tell me that. Google has to tell me who he supports, because I did actually have a look to see who he did. But he's for Bears Den, so I think we've probably got to actually say he was maybe a Partick Thistle fan. Or he would maybe a claim to be a Partick Thistle fan. You ken what I mean? So he does the split the divide in Glasgow.
Aye, I get it.
He's a Broadway star now. He's a big theatre guy now. Mm-hmm. He does all the musicals and all that. Anyway, move on for Darius. Move on. The albums. Number one albums. The number one album was By the Way by the Red Hot Chili Peppers. Do you like the Red Hot Chili Peppers?
liked them, and then I seen them at Teen the Park. Nah, terrible. They were awful at Teen the Park. But in fairness, I mean, no, in fact, there was no excuse. They were honest. They were just draws. I think they headlined it one year. The girl pal of mine at the time, her dad worked for like the Sunday Mail or something. So we got like hospitality tickets this year, which was class, man. You know what I mean? Like, it was amazing. Like, but you know, we were young. 2005, it must be 2006 or 7 when I don't know what year the Chili Peppers made. I'm just chucking years out there. Whatever year they played, anyway. And that was the only band. Basically, I got a free reign that whole weekend to take her to whoever I wanted to go see. She was cool with that. She was like, nah, your tunes are fine. And then she goes, but I want to see the Red Hot Chili Peppers and Dross. Absolute Dross. But, I mean, obviously, if they come on the radio and that, a few good songs. By the way, obviously, was that album, is that the one that's got Can't Stop on it as well?
I don't know.
It was a tune. But I mean, one of those bands that they seem to have like a sort of second coming in the mid-2000s, didn't they? They went actually, you know, really, really mainstream popular again, the Red Hot Chili Peppers. And I suppose, they're one of those bands that I think if you put on, you know, five songs for that era that they had that were top 10 hits, you'd go, it's not like, I'm gonna put it on, you know, put it on when I get home and that, but I think it's, well, you know, good enough tunes.
I think one of the songs I remember for that time was Roller Coaster. And I think that was for a film, was that not for the Simpsons film or something like that? We're getting completely mixed up there.
I've got no idea, man.
I've got no idea either. In the comments, before we go into your album, in the comments there's been a lot of love for Turn On The Bright Lights by Interpol, which came out in August 2002.
Yeah.
Now, this is now one of my favourite albums of all time, but I must admit, in 2002, this passed me by. And I only got into Interpol over the last couple of years because I started getting into Scottish bands, well, the last 10 years. Zinko's right, it was Beavis and Butthead that done Roller Coaster. It wasn't the Simpsons.
Roller Coaster of Love, that's what I was thinking in my head. So
the Turn On The Bright Lights, over the last 10 years, I've got really into the Twilight Sad and that. And I read an interview with the singer for the Twilight Sad, and he says Interpol were a massive influence on him. So I went back and listened to them. And for a band that come from Manhattan, they sounded like they came from Scotland. They've got that sort of sound that the Cocteau Twins had, and like when you listen to bands like the Twilight Sad and Frightened Rabbit and that, you can see the Interpol influence in them.
Wow.
But because I had actually listened to the Twilight Sad first, when I listen to Interpol, I can actually hear a Scottish band. Basically, Interpol were influenced by the Cocteau Twins. Do you know who the Cocteau Twins are? Is that before your time?
Nah. No, I know who they are. I know who they are. I've got one of their tunes on my Spotify. Can't remember the name of it now, but it's good.
Fantastic band for Grangemouth. Obviously, Grangemouth's got its own global ecosystem because of the chemical works there. Eh? So there must be something in the air in Grangemouth. It never snows in Grangemouth because it's too warm. So I never got into that album until the last 5 or 6 years. So when we were picking albums for this, I says I need to mention that album. It's a fantastic album, and if anybody's watching this, hasn't they went to listen to this, or hasn't they listened to any of the Interpol stuff, go and do it. It's fantastic. Right. You're not going to be disappointed. I'm going to. So what's your album from that week that was in the charts at that time?
So my album is a bit of an obvious one, but There's a bit of a connection there for me, Kev. So it's Queen's Greatest Hits 1, 2, and 3 was released, the big silver compilation. But, like, my dad brought me up on Queen in the 90s, you know what I mean? That was Saturday nights. It would just be, like, me picking what Queen VHS I wanted on. Tended to be Greatest Hits too every time. Like, didn't get me wrong, I just picked the same one because I was young and stupid. But I don't know. It was just one of those bands that I knew all their songs by the time, you know, I'd left primary school. Do you know what I mean? Like, it was one of those. I don't know. Just one of those bands, and I think when I look back, that was like my dad's favourite band. Obviously, he's not here now and all that. Kev, it's a shame and stuff. And I just think, as a wee doff of the cap to him, I thought I would be letting the team down if I didn't pick Queen's Greatest Hits 1, 2 and 3. I had to do that, man.
What's your favourite Queen song?
Favourite Queen songs? Difficult. So there's a couple. I think Under Pressure with David Bowie. I think there's a lot of relief with that song as well, purely because thank God it was good. Thank God it wasn't the Frog song, you know what I mean? And I think the other one that I really like is Hammer to Fall. I think that's a good rock and roll track. Loads of good songs, though.
What did you think of the Queen film that was released a couple of years ago?
I thought Brian May and Roger Taylor had a lot more say-so in that storyline than what was actually more likely the reality. And there was wee bits that they added in. I thought, you know, because I've watched loads of documentaries about them and stuff, and there's just no way they... Like, there was a wee silly bit, which I don't know why it annoyed me, Kev, but it did, right? And they were in the recording studio or whatever, and I think it was ahead of reuniting for the Live Aid gig, and they hadn't spoke for 2 years or whatever. And there's just this silly, needless bit in the film where they send Freddie Mercury out the room, and it goes to Brian May, and he went, why'd you do that? He goes, I just felt like it. Because obviously Freddie Mercury was meant to be coming back all humble and really sorry for how rude he'd been and stuff. And I just thought, as if that happened, who are you trying to kid? Did they go, tell to Bill? Honestly, there's just no way that happened. And I just thought, you know, you're trying to rewrite it a wee bit so you don't look like, you know, you are pushed about maybe as much. But at the end of the day, there was only one Freddie Mercury. He was the dominant force. And there was nobody putting him out the room to stand outside like a naughty girl because Brian May felt like it. I just thought stuff like that there was no need for. That was just them protecting their own egos. And I kind of respect John Deacon for the fact that he went, I'll do the tribute gig. And then he went, after that, that's it. No Freddie, no Queen for me. He says, it'll never be the same. There's no point in kidding on that it will be. I always admired that, you know, about. I mean, as much as I don't take anything away from them carrying on, because that's all they know. They've earned the right to play live. Of course they have. There's no two ways about it, but I think to try and replace an unstoppable force like Freddie Mercury was never possible. But I know definitely. I mean, I've got a Freddie Mercury tattoo in my arm and that, man. I love him, so.
Wow! I was never a big Queen fan, but this will be before your time. But I remember watching them on Live Aid. And everybody, I was 9 at the time of Live Aid, and got knowing that was something special at that point, even though I never went on to like the music. But I remember seeing going, that's quite special. That I can actually see that guy's a performer and he's got something. Strangely enough, there was 3 bands in Live Aid who completely made a major impression on me. U2.
Yeah.
The Who. And Status Quo, and I've seen all 3 of them live. So there you go. My album from that. Now, we spoke yesterday, and when I started having a look through the charts, there is a reason why like the Interpol album never came on my radar, because I could have chose 5 albums from this week. It was a great time for music for me. One of the albums was the Coral's debut album, The Coral, which is a fantastic album. Everybody who thought they were getting Dreaming of You, then get hit with reggae sea shanties about mermaids.
Did that have Simon Diamond on it or something like that as well?
No, it didn't. No, that one. Or did it?
Is it not?
Oh, I can't remember.
I thought it was on that. I could be wrong now. I know what you're saying. I mean, they were a band that I've seen them live a few times as well, Kevin. You know, I think definitely when they came out with Dreaming of You, it wasn't necessarily like this is how it's going to be going forward, but they're a good live band as well. I've seen them a few times, The Coral, funnily enough.
I've never actually seen them live, strangely enough, and I do like their back catalogue. I do like Bill Ryder Jones' soul stuff as well. That's a completely different direction for The Coral. There's a lot of love coming in the comments for the Status Quo. I love Status Quo. I've said that before on this podcast. I love The Quo. So you had the Coral, you've got The Streets, her original pirate material out at that time, which was an album I actually utterly played to death. Then you've got the two albums that I couldn't make up my mind about. You've got the last broadcast, Bedoves, one of the greatest albums of the 21st century, in my opinion. This should have made Doves the biggest band on the planet for me. This album, There Goes the Fear, Words, what other songs? Pounding.
Pounding, I remember when it came out. And being like, what's this? I need a bit more of that. And then, as you say, There Goes the Fear. That's the two that really stick out. I mean, There Goes the Fear's brilliant melody. It's a bit Stone Roses-y at times, to be fair. And it goes on too long. That song, There Goes the Fear, must go on for about 7 minutes.
No, I love the way it goes into the Rio Carnival bit and that. I think that's fantastic. For me, that's a great album. I remember seeing them with my wife at Tea in the Park, and it was a Sunday night, and I think it was about 6 o'clock on the second stage on the Sunday night. And one of my many predictions that's never came true, I says that they would be headlining Tea in the Park the following year. They never, still haven't done it, but for me, the reason that they haven't done it is because they look like bin men. They haven't got an image like Coldplay. For me, they're
like
far
Screamer Celica.
Aye, well,
they've not got an image like Screamer Celica, mate. That's it. You know what I mean? It's all part of it, Kev. That's the thing. See, for me, it is, mate. See, if you look at a band, you want to be them, I think. Do you know what I mean? You want to look at the band, he's cool. Like, he's the man. You know what I mean? I think there's got to be a bit of that in it.
I think as well, you look at certain bands and you look at the front men and that, you could be like Doves. You have a look at, they had that look about them where you go, well, I can look like that if I want to, because it was a sort of every man kind of look. And
nobody wants that. You want to be looking at someone and going, he looks out. This is my take on it. I suppose it's that, but mine would be like, he looks like a superstar. You know, would I get away with that, Jacob? That's right. That is generally how I would look at it.
So, are you trying to tell us you had a phase of looking like Freddie Mercury then, when you were younger? Like, got a bit with the white vests and the bleached denims and all of that.
I've often contemplated the black and white leotard for a Celtic State of Mind on a Monday, man, but no, not worried yet.
So, I've got the last broadcast by Doves, an utterly fantastic album, which I played to death round about that time. As soon as I started going back to this game, I had a wee Peugeot 206, and I remember listening to this album constantly that the month it came out, and I'm going, that reminds me of getting beat off Bow. As soon as I saw it again, I says, that reminds me of getting beat off Bow, that album. The first track on it, the intro, then into Words. I think Words is one of the greatest songs that Doves have ever done. Also in the charts then, at number 9 was a Primal Scream with their new album Evil Heat. And if everybody will be aware, if I move away, I'm a massive Primal Scream fan. I can't do that, right? I'll just leave that. I'm a massive Primal Scream fan. And Evil Heat was at their peak. Techno, punk, protest, psych, acid rock, Krautrock's phase, and that's a fantastic, for me it's a brilliant album. Absolutely, they released two albums at the turn of the century, Exterminator and Evil Heat, then an album after that, Live in Japan. Anybody that hasn't heard the Live in Japan album by the Primal Scream, go and listen to it. This is peak Primal Scream, absolutely noisy Primal Scream. And for
do
me,
you call them the Primal Scream?
I could go, aye, well, the Primal Scream.
No, I'm just interested. I thought that was maybe I think it just depends
on how I'm flown. I've
never heard that before. I was just interested.
How I'm hitting the bars, man. If I'm flown, I'll maybe actually say the Primal Scream.
The Primal Scream, I like that. There used to be a nightclub in Stirling called Dusk, and I used to always call it The Dusk. I thought it was called The Dusk because I was too old to be going there, really. I was like, are we going to The Dusk tonight? And my younger pals, like, they were like, shut up, mate. It's not called The Dusk.
Well, you call it Dusk. It was the Rainbow Rocks and Mad Amy. I can still remember vaguely, and I didn't go into it this at this point, but I remember being in Stirling when I think the foo bar was called Maxwell's 3D. Wow. I can remember seeing a sign for Maxwell's 3D who said, I must have only been about 4 or 5 at the time. Eh? What is the name of your favourite Doves album, Kevin? It's either the last broadcast or the one that they've had out this year. The one that they had out last year. That's my two favourite Doves albums. The Universal Want. I love Doves. I really do. I missed them when they played at the SWG3 last year. But I've got tickets to go and see them at the Barrowlands when they play at the Barrows, if that ever happens. Which it looks like it will. Me and Nick was telling us that everything's going to be normal, but we're going to be in an intermediate post-COVID in June. So hopefully gigs will start happening. Because
so, man.
I think I've got tickets to go and see the Primal Scream. I've got tickets to go and see the Primal Scream at the Bandstand in Glasgow, and also the Jesus and Mary Chain at the Bandstand in
David Kelly, very good though. Very good. The Primal Scream, did they liquidate and buy the old Primal Screams this way?
Well, I think if you probably ask the Primal Scream, you might find that they didn't own their own back catalogue. So that could be true. They probably had to liquidate themselves after. I think they need that. Because Moving On Up appeared on a insurance advert, and I remember the Primal Scream coming out and saying, "Aye, we couldn't do nothing about that because we didn't own the rights there."
Wow, okay, that's unusual.
Aye, it's a publishing company that owned the rights there, but I don't know whether that's changed now.
Yeah, it's strange, eh?
Well, Russell, that's us been an hour and 16 minutes. I've enjoyed tonight. We've went back to Baal and we've dug into...
Loved it, man.
When I've actually started looking back, this was a really decent time for music, a really decent time for stuff I still listen to this day, which is quite bizarre. So, Russell, thank you very much.
Everybody, my pleasure.
Everybody who's commented, everybody who's enjoyed this, please subscribe below. Share with your friends. Remember, don't take us too serious. Ant and Deck on Saturday Night Takeaway actually said this is they have the best minute of the week when they give away like prizes and free holidays and that. Me and Russell can't give away free holidays, but this is the best hour of the week that Celtic fans are having at this precise moment. So keep the faith, lads. Hell, see you later.
As the number one audio company, iHeartMedia gives you access to all, every audience, live conversations, trusted influencers, and the insights and data you need to grow. iHeartMedia is your access company. Go to iHeartResults.com for more.
Sports Social Podcast Network. 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 Sports Social Podcast Network.
Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. That should brighten your day a little. Actually, a lot. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18+.